Hi, everyone. Dan Cassidy here. Welcome back to the Washington Weekly Podcast on the UBS In The Now podcast channel. Joining us for the conversation, glad to welcome back Shane Lieberman, Senior Governmental Affairs Advisor with Governmental Affairs U.S. here at UBS. Shane, thank you for dropping by on this Thursday morning. Looking forward to our conversation.
Thank you, Dan. Always good to be back with you.
So, Shane, there's a few topics I want to cover this week to bring our listeners up to speed on a variety of key issues. Though before we do that, I, of course, have to acknowledge how today marks the 80th anniversary of D-Day, the Normandy landings of World War II by the United States and allied nations, which was a pivotal moment in world history, which changed the tide of the war, though, of course, came at a tremendous cost. So I'm curious, how is D-Day being remembered today by U.S. as well as European leaders?
Thanks for bringing this up. You know, I spent some time last night, you know, just kind of reading and refreshing my memory about the sacrifice that was made on D-Day. 80 years ago, 165,000 brave young men stormed the beaches in France to liberate Europe from the Nazis. And, you know, thousands died that day. I believe 2,500 Americans were killed, with thousands of others and, of course, thousands more wounded. And, you know, it's just an incredible undertaking and feat by the Allied forces to liberate Europe. And, you know, I don't think we should forget it. And I would encourage everyone last night, one of the things I read was General Eisenhower's letter to the troops. It was a quick, short, fantastic read. I highly recommend all of you to, if you can find it online, take a quick read of it. But also in that context of what's going on in Europe, you know, President Biden and many other European leaders are meeting in France to honor this 80th anniversary of D-Day. But there's this undertone of what is still going on in Eastern Europe and Ukraine. And so, you know, you definitely see Biden and others drawing parallels to the defense of Ukraine and its war with Russia. So, you know, while you know, we have struggles today, I do think, to your heart of your question, we should all take a moment to remember, you know, the sacrifice that was made for freedom 80 years ago.
Well, Shane, thank you for sharing how the anniversary today and those who were there on that day are being honored and remembered, a day never to forget. So if we come back stateside, a few topics to bring our listeners up to speed on. Earlier this week, we did witness Dr. Anthony Fauci testify on Capitol Hill about the origins of the COVID-19 pandemic. Probably fair to say it was contentious at times, though I'm curious to hear what you took away from this week's testimony.
Yeah, no, you're right. It was contentious. Of course, you know, as we have talked about in the past on several occasions, you know, the headlines often focus on, you know, a moment during the hearing that is not reflective of, you know, the full hearing. You know, the moment, if you will, for this hearing was Congresswoman Marjorie Taylor Greene refusing to call Dr. Fauci a doctor. And of course, that led to this, the Republican chairman of the subcommittee, you know, saying to Congressman Taylor Greene, you know, he is a doctor, please refer to him as doctor, you know. And of course, that is the story, but there was so much more covered. You know, from the Democrats' view, you know, they didn't really see anything new, you know, revelations, if you will. You know, I think Republicans went after Dr. Fauci hard. And there was, I think, there is still to some degree some confusion about, you know, how things played out. For example, you know, the origins of COVID-19 to some degree are still unknown. You know, we know that the origins are from China, but, you know, was this a natural thing or was there a lab leak? If there was a lab leak, you know, was this a test that, you know, the impact of the virus was boosted. So, you know, there was a lot of back and forth in the hearing. You know, obviously no, you know, certain conclusions. I think there was some rebuke for some of Dr. Fauci's staff about use of personal email and, you know, were they using grants in a nefarious manner, to try and get people on board with their talking points. Republicans went after Dr. Fauci for things like, social distancing, which he pegged to the CDC's guidelines, not his. So a lot of back and forth. But at the end of the day, I think there's a lot of political rhetoric and no, hard takeaways that, for us, impact the future. I think I am kind of concerned in the sense that, you have this fracture between Congress and, the NIH. And what does that mean if we're faced with another pandemic that is even more deadly? There is a degree of healthy skepticism, but, if we're in this situation again and we're just divided as a country, and the death rate and the toll it takes is really worse, that could be a precarious position we find ourselves in.
That is a very interesting point, and thank you, Shane, for providing some takeaways from this week's testimony of Dr. Anthony Fauci. Outside of the testimony, another development out of Washington, which made headlines this week, we're now turning to the White House. We did see President Biden did issue an executive order aimed at the U.S. southern border, a topic we've been covering here on the podcast a lot over the past few years. So what does the action consist of and anticipate impact?
This is a really interesting one from a variety of reasons, from the policy itself, but also the politics. For a while now, immigration has been falling as a issue top of mind to voters, which really has put President Biden and his administration in a precarious position, as they have been seen by many Americans as not being active on this. President Biden at times has demurred that he didn't have authority to do anything. It was really Congress, and Congress has not been able to reach any kind of bipartisan compromise here. But lo and behold, this had been in the making for a few weeks, and it was long anticipated that he'd be releasing this executive order. And, it does a few things. I think most notably is that there's a trigger that if more than 2,500 legal crossings happen, that would trigger a shutdown of the asylum system for a period of time. Notably, this looks familiar to me, as this was something in that bipartisan bill proposed earlier this year that failed. But the trigger was actually higher. It had a 5,000 illegal crossing number attached to it. So, part of this, though, is the U.S. is going to depend on Mexico to take in immigrants that are rejected under this order. And, remember, Mexico just had a election this past weekend, and they have a new president incoming, and it remains to be seen how she's going to react. At the same time, Congress has not provided any new funds to help carry out this shift in policy. So there remains to be a lot to be seen here. And of course, I think there will probably be legal challenges. On the political side, this is not being well received by, the hawks who are extremely concerned by illegal immigration. And then on the flip side, President Biden's base is, concerned that he is clamping down on, those seeking asylum and, trying to come to the country to work. That's not being well received. So I do scratch my head a little bit in the sense of, will this actually placate anyone and help him kind of take the immigration issue off the table in the election? I lean towards it not helping at the end of the day in the political sense. I think in the policy sense, it may provide some relief on the border, but we'll have to see how it's implemented and, what really comes to fruition here.
Yep, it is something that we'll continue to track, and it will be interesting to see how this plays out, especially as you mentioned, when you factor in the needed commitments from the new administration in Mexico as well. So thank you, Shane, for keeping us informed on this development. I want to turn overseas, though this, of course, also involves the Biden administration here at home, this following up on the Israel-Hamas war. There have been some developments surrounding a potential or perhaps new ceasefire plan. So from what you know, what might this consist of and what might be the prospects for something of the sort to be implemented or even agreed on?
Yeah, I do feel like there's a little bit of he said, she said here. There was some grander talk by the Biden administration of a ceasefire a few days ago, and that obviously has not materialized. I think you're seeing President Biden really try to squeeze Prime Minister Netanyahu to agree to a ceasefire, and Israel is not ready to do that yet. I think they are in a position where they see significant gains being made in Gaza, and tragically, they have recovered the bodies of numerous hostages in the past week or so. And I don't think they see their work being done yet. So I do not expect a ceasefire in Gaza. And you're seeing, I think, Prime Minister Netanyahu really signal that as well. Eventually, I'm hopeful that there'll be one. But I don't think we're within days of that, as press reports showed just a few days ago. This war is still ongoing and still hot. And, the reality is that, with Iran instigating not only in Gaza, but to the north in Lebanon, the Middle East still remains a very hotbed of activity that is a real tinderbox in the region, but here we are several months after October 7th, and the war has widened. And I think, we're in a good position that hopefully it won't widen further. There have been attempts to have it widened by Iran when they launched over 300 drones and missiles at Israel. But I think right now the stability, and this is somewhat sad to say, is that, the conflict is limited right now to Gaza. The stability of, a ceasefire is elusive at the time, but I think, we're maybe a few months away from it.
Well, a lot of moving parts. We'll continue to keep an eye on this, though very helpful to have some clarity given what we've been hearing over the past few days. So, Shane, thank you as always for spending time with our listeners, our clients, and for keeping us all informed on a wide range of issues here at home as well as overseas. And do look forward to picking back up with our conversation again soon. Though, have a nice weekend, Shane. Thank you again.
Thank you, Dan. Look forward to it.
Again, today we have been joined by Shane Lieberman, Senior Governmental Affairs Advisor with Governmental Affairs U.S. here at UBS. Before we close out, I do want to remind our listeners that you can now locate the latest Washington Weekly publication available for you on ubs.com/Washington Weekly. From UBS Studios, I'm Dan Cassidy. Thank you for joining us. Thank you for tuning in. Be sure to visit ubs.com/studios to view the entire UBS Studios suite of podcast channels, along with our video offerings, such as UBS Trending. You can also follow us on Instagram for content highlights at UBS Trending. UBS Studios is part of the UBS Chief Investment Office within UBS Global Wealth Management. Visit ubs.com/CIO to view the latest research.
As a firm providing wealth management services to clients, UBS Financial Services, Inc. offers investment advisory services in its capacity as an SEC-registered investment advisor and brokerage services in its capacity as an SEC-registered broker-dealer. Investment advisory services and brokerage services are separate and distinct, differ in material ways, and are governed by different laws and separate arrangements. It is important that you understand the ways in which we conduct business and that you carefully read the agreement and disclosures that we provide to you about the products or services we offer. For more information, please review client relationship summary provided at ubs.com/relationship summary or ask your UBS financial advisor for a copy.